This is a Pinball News production.
Thanks very much. Can you all hear me? Okay, so what we're going to do today is people always like to understand where, you know, what game designers are all about, and I get a lot of questions about, you know, where we come from and how we come to be. So I'm going to spend a little bit of time on a segment of my career that you may or may not know anything about. I'll talk to you about how I got started and sort of how I got to where I am today. Along the way, we eventually will transition into more recent work, and we will finish up with a lot of stuff about Transformers, which is on the assembly lines right now for the Pro models, and the LEs will soon follow, and I'm very proud of that game, and so I'm going to talk to you a lot about that. So let's get rolling. So believe it or not, that's where it all began. that's a picture of the my Bachelor of Arts in Design from the University of Illinois in Chicago. As Frank Zappa would say, I'm not a Sears designer, I'm a real designer. and that's a picture of me, 26 years old, at Midway Games. I was working on coin-operated video games. That's how I broke into the business. I went right from design school straight to Midway in October of 1978. If you look closely at the sketch on my drawing table, it looks like a cabinet that looks like a TIE fighter, and that's because that's what it is. I was trying to talk the company into getting me a Star Wars license. Atari beat me to it. I still sketch the old-fashioned way, only some of my newfangled sketch tools are substantially different than a piece of paper, but I still use a piece of paper. There you see me on my Wacom Cintiq. Looks and feels like sort of my traditional tools that I learned with, and so for that reason, I really like it. This is random, and it's not in any particular order. This is a line of peripherals that I did while I was at Midway, intended to get Midway a bread-and-butter product. Midway's fortunes were always tied to the success or failure of a game, and I felt that we needed a bread-and-butter product line that could sustain failures of a game. And so what this did was I tried to create a scenario where everyone's games would work with the Midway peripherals, but when the Midway peripheral saw the Midway game, it unlocked all kinds of cool things that you couldn't get any other way with anyone else's peripheral, including the PlayStation controller. For example, you know, more cars, more tracks, more fighters, more characters, more events, more levels, etc. And of course, because of our roots were in the arcades, I named it Race. Real arcade control equipment. And I did, you know, all kinds of, you know, bike controllers. Guns were not illegal yet for kids. And so, you know, this is my attempt at making a passable gun for kids. Yellow camouflage. I spent some time as a toy designer of conventional toys.
Ready? It's Crash and Bash Demo Derby.
Boys playing Crash and Bash again, dear?
Where you try to demolish the other guy's car. Crash him forward. Bash him back. You tear each other's car apart piece by piece.
You're history!
Until there's nothing left. Crash and Bash Demo Derby comes with everything you see here. Batteries not included. From Galoo.
It's, 1985 for a company in your backyard right here in San Fran, Galoob Toys. I was working for a big consulting firm in Chicago called Marvin Glass & Associates. I think some of you know that I had a lot of success with Spy Hunter as a very young man, the original arcade version. And so one day I was sitting at Midway and I got a call just recently before Midway closed. I want to say it was 07 or something, and And I got a call from one of the marketing guys, and they said, you know, we got a call from Pontiac, and they want to use Spy Hunter in a commercial. And I was like, really?
Your love for car has never been more real. Introducing the first ever Pontiac GA GT, the most powerful car under 30 grand.
So it turns out that the guy at the ad agency and the product manager within Pontiac were about the age that when they were kids, they were playing Spy Hunter. And so they said, hey, you know, the demographic for this car is now old enough to buy a Pontiac G8. So I'm sorry Pontiac didn't make it, but I was very pleasantly surprised. And then I was at Midway until 08 when it folded. And one of the things that always sort of irked me over the years is that I worked on other projects. I never, ever again got to work on a Spy Hunter. And so, I don't know what you know about the current video game business, but it's a very, very pricey and expensive and risky venture. So every time a game designer at a mid-level publisher says, I want to make a video game, that company has to come up with somewhere between $15 and $30 million. So, which if you're at a big company, it's $100 million. So at Midway, it was somewhere between $15 and $30 million. And to get my 15 or 30, I would have to do what they call the treatment. And a treatment is sort of what can you put together in a month and a half, couple of months maybe, with a really small team of guys, four or five guys, that's going to give us the look and feel of the game. We can test it with certain audiences. We can get data. And then we can tell you whether or not we're going to write you a check for $30 million. So the last thing I pitched, it was one of the most fun summers at Midway, because I knew that more than likely I was going to get laid off in December, and I had just shipped the last version of NBA Ballers, and so I had a summer to do nothing. And so I said, you know, what the hell, I'm gonna pitch a new Spy Hunter as I would do it. So this is the treatment. I won't bore you with the entire thing, but I'll give you a little glimpse at it. You guys can bring the lights back up. Thanks. So, you know, that on a good day will get you a check for $30 million. this is me in Spy Hunter 3. I was the bad guy. The guys that were making it made me the guy that wanted to rule the world. So if you have a Spy Hunter 3 and you load it up, I am running around the game being bad. This is, now for something completely different, this is a redemption game that I did for Bromley in the early 90s, right back when Gulf Wars were popular. We were about to go into the Gulf War, and so this is, it's a remake, in essence, the play mechanic is a remake of, the old Midway, Whirlybirds and stuff. But I had all these targets in the game animated mechanically. And so this game is significant because it went to a trade show, an AMOA show, and it was during that trade show that the Williams designers actually took note of me because they saw the game, liked the game, and then and that's how I was approached to come to work at Williams. This is the day that Batman lent me the car, and this is on the set of The Dark Knight in Chicago. I don't know if some of this stuff is it's probably old. You guys have probably seen this because it's old. You know, it's Batman old at this point. This is, when I, so historically, a lot of designers don't delve into the same level of detail for things like mechanisms that I do. I'm blessed that I came up in the business surrounded by some really good mechanical engineers, and they instilled in me the fact that my stuff would be a lot better if I didn't just throw it over the fence. So I don't throw my stuff over the fence. When a mechanical engineer gets a device for a pinball machine from me, it's pretty well thought out. A lot of guys just, wave their arms, walk into the mechanical engineer's office, and then walk out. And I give them really, really tight stuff. This sketch is a sketch that I made about how that entire mechanism worked on Batman. And my engineers have gotten to really appreciate that level of detail. I don't worry too much about how much torque the motor needs or how many bearings he needs to do what he does or how, you know, what gauge steel he should use. But I do worry about conceptually getting him in the ballpark, so to speak. This is some of the Batman stuff. I work in every medium. I build things. I draw the old-fashioned way. And I love all of my newfangled CAD tools. So I consider it a blessing that I spent the first 15 years of my life professionally drawing on a drawing board, because I think that the breadth of that experience makes my stuff better. And it makes me more powerful in terms of the things that I can execute. This is all Batman stuff. I'm also a pain in the ass for my art directors, and that's because design schools are part of art schools typically, and so that means that I had to learn about color, and I had to learn about drawing, and I had to learn about composition as part of my design degree. So when I get something from Kevin, and Kevin and I have been working together since 1979, so. We work together at Midway, and so he tolerates me really well, and we get along famously, and he does great stuff, and I think we do great stuff together, and that's why you continue to see Kevin as my go-to guy on things like, you know, all my games, like Monster Bash and Batman, et cetera, because I really like working with him, and this is the kind of critique that he gets back from me, and he's used to it. He doesn't take any offense. And sometimes when he's lacking for ideas, he sends me the thing that he's working on, and I give it back to him with some, you know, why don't you try this? So it's a really good relationship. Okay, so let's talk about Transformers, More Than Meets the Eye. There's going to be, I'm hoping to save lots of time for Q&A. So when I sat down to start Transformers, the very, very first thought that I had was that it should really be about the Transformers. With all due respect to Michael Bay and the movies and the films, et cetera, I really wanted it to be about the robots. It occurred to me that wouldn't it be fun to give you the choice of being an Autobot or a Decepticon right from the get-go. So when you walk up to the machine, not only is the machine dressed in Autobot Crimson to the right and Decepticon Violet to the left, but everything is consistent throughout, and you will be asked to make a choice. Are you an Autobot or are you a Decepticon? And depending on the choice you make, the machine will transform to play with you appropriately. So if you choose to be an Autobot, Optimus Prime will help you, all of the Autobots will be on your side, and all of the Decepticons will be your enemies. And if you choose to be a Decepticon, vice versa. That simple thought, are you an Autobot or a Decepticon, became the sort of the battle cry of the game. It was the simplest way for me to convey the notion of the game to the guys on the team, to the guys in the plant, to everyone around me. And so whenever in doubt, we always went back to the mantra, are you an Autobot or are you a Decepticon? And it came up a lot as we were developing the rules of the game, as we were developing the devices in the game, etc. The game adjusts based on what you select. You'll fight either Autobots or Decepticons. The boss will either be Optimus Prime or Megatron. So this creates two ways to play. I want you guys to want to play through as an Autobot and experience the world of the Autobots from their perspective, and I want you to play through as a Decepticon and experience the vision of a Decepticon. So, and I quickly resolved all of the issues of, well, wait, what happens when I'm Optimus and I'm bashing Optimus? I said, oh, no, you'll be an Autobot, and Optimus, he's going to be training you. It's going to be, he's going to be testing your accuracy. So these little things allowed me to fit the fiction to the physical realities of the game. Optimus and Megatron are the two big toys on the game, although, Megatron brings with him a rapid-fire multi-ball, which I think is a very cool event, which I think you guys will look forward to seeing. And Optimus is the primary bash toy in the game, very, very available to anyone, including a novice. In addition to that, the LE versions are chock full with additional toys. There is a transforming mini playfield. There's lots of stuff that I can tell you about a little later, and some that I can't tell you about yet, because it's kind of fun to have secrets that you will discover when you play the game. So I like to write, and this is my version. This was my version of the instruction card until the marketing guys read it. Is your banner crimson or violet? Will you join the Decepticon uprising or defend the rights of all sentient beings alongside Optimus Prime? Use control input buttons to select. Launch the chromium sphere to confirm. Boot up launch protocol. Accurately propel the spherical projectile into the illuminated top lanes to engage the machine. I got to tell you, I wrote this, sent it out. There was a marketing guy in my office in 30 seconds flat. Optimus Prime Polysphere combat. Ever played Polyspheres? You've not played Polyspheres? Dare you challenge the power of Megatron? Lock and load spherical projectiles to engage Megatron in combat. Are you sure you want to do that? It's perfectly good English to me. Okay, this is my hand-built prototype for the very, very early Megatron. You'll see that some minor changes to the one that made it into the game. I think this is a little movie. So, in the game, the cool part about it is that, he says all sorts of appropriate and inappropriate things, depending on where you hit him with the ball. And of course, through the magic of pinball, there are, numerous flash lamps and sound effects and, all that stuff goes with it. It's a snapshot of my notebooks. This is a fan favorite. Every show I go to, people want to see the sketches because they know I do them, right? Jim Shelberg hounds me for them. Can you please send me the sketches for Pin Game Journal, etc.? So literally, snapshots from pages in my notebooks. Some ramp stuff I was working on. You can see right here, at one point in time, the Megatron toy was the Megatron truck. And the ball would hit it, and then he would transform. We could not do that. So one of the coolest things about Stern Pinball is the power of Stern Pinball. And what do I mean by that? We have a history in licensing, and we're, Gary has built a really respectable reputation in terms of licenses in the licensing community. Anyone and everyone with a brand knows who we are, and when we approach them, they understand in a lot of situations exactly what we're doing. What you are looking at is the Industrial Light and Magic model, Max model for, actually it was a Maya model to start, and I had to convert it to Max because I work in Max, of Megatron, the very model that was used in the film. And so I had access to that, and I called ILM, and they sent me the model, and I used the model to pose Megatron for things like art. And at one point in time, I actually considered their model to mold things. And now I'm going to show you some really fun stuff, because I brought the model, and I brought 3D Studio Max. This model is enormous. I mean, it's like enormous in terms of computer memory. Here's what I want you to see. Look at the detail in that sucker. This is the Megatron from the last film. You can see that half of his head is blown away, right? Because he was damaged in the second film. So, the magic of movie making. Every one of these parts is glued together strictly in the CAD model, which means that good luck trying to mold this thing. But it was great to have, because we posed him for art, posed him and rendered him for art. And so, and I could say, if we were any other company, there is no way in hell that ILM is sending a Megatron model out of house for anyone to do anything with. So there's your insight into some of the cool things that we get to work with. Later on, I'm going to take you right inside my CAD system, and we are going to look at transformers in detail. All right. These are some back glasses that did not make it. You guys always love to look at this stuff. Actually, you can see the model right there, right? This is before we rendered them, and you can see some of our chicken scratch on here, things that we considered were wrong, you know, like this arm was right in front of Optimus's head. And, you know, his claws were closed, and it would be more dramatic if they were open. You can also see at this point in time, I had not established that Autobots were crimson and Decepticons were violet. And so you can see that I had made the border on this side blue and the border on this side red. Actually, it was Michael Bay who he took the eyes of Megatron and all of the Decepticons and turned them red, and all of the Autobots are blue. And so I sort of picked up on that, only to be corrected by Mark Galvez, the CG artist on my team, who said to me, Mark is probably what, Gary, 20 years younger than I am? He's a guy. Okay, so Mark is a guy who was actually watching, you know, Transformers on TV in the 80s when I was designing toys, and he said to me, he said, dude, you know, these colors are wrong. And I said, what do you mean? He goes, Decepticons are purple. when you're gonna see we ended up producing four distinct backglasses. We produced a Pro backglass, which you've seen. We produced a Combo LE backglass, and we produced a Decepticon backglass and an Autobot backglass. When you see all of the backglasses, it'll be interesting for you to remember these, because one of the things that we had to go away from really quickly is the surface characteristics of the robots are so complex. The machinery is so complex that when I laid one robot on top of another, Even if one was an Autobot and he was, you know, like, say, Bumblebee yellow, it was impossible to see what was going on. And so you will see that there's a lot of negative space between the images of the robots in all of the art in Transformers. It had to happen. There was no other way. Otherwise, you get messes like this. The reason I rejected that backlash is, who the hell can tell what's going on? This is a reject Decepticon backlash. And pay special attention to the corners of the glass. What do you see? QR codes. Yes, they are. We'll talk about those in a second. So, by the way, this is a reject backlash. This is not the Decepticon backlash. And here you have QR codes. So every version of Transformers has QR codes, and every version's QR codes are unique to the game. And the QR codes are a little bit like a scavenger hunt. You go through the game, and some of them will be very obvious to you immediately, like the four on the back glass, and some of them will be less obvious to you. And my hope is that you all are crawling all over the games with your phones trying to find the QR codes. I'm sure Gary's in the back of the room raising his eyebrows because he doesn't want people in a bar crawling on top of a Transformers in France. So QR codes will not only show you cool stuff. I'm going to give you a hint. Some of the best QR codes are orange. What do you think that means? No idea? Dot Matrix. Wow. And that, you know what that means? That means that I control when that code comes out, doesn't it? That means that actually you control when that code comes out, because I can tie a code to score, and then I can reveal the code, and then I will give you time to capture the code, and then you will get real power that affects the game. So some QR codes are more important than others, and some mean cooler things than others. And Transformers was a natural debut for this idea. And it will be a first in pinball, no doubt. And it will evolve. And so a lot of our future products will incorporate this technology, and we will be doing all kinds of cool things with it. These are snapshots of the brochures for the pro version. You can see some of the stuff. You can see the one of my favorite things, the Bumblebee, the captive Camaro. It's a captive ball behind a Bumblebee Camaro, and when you hit the ball, the Camaro runs up the lane and hits a target. It's really fun. The Ironhide ramp and the Optimus ramp. Over here you have the LE versions get the Transformer version of Megatron and the robot form, as it's known, and the pros get the alternate form, which is the tank, which is what you're seeing here. And the LE version is animated, so he's mechanically animated, and as opposed to the pro version, which is just simply illuminated. The Decepticon ramp, which I will show you in a minute, and the all-powerful AllSpark cube. It's one of the cool things about this particular playfield, and I'm going to show you this in a little bit. I in spite of what you read on RGP, all my games are not the same. So. And I love to prove it, so you're going to get to see. I love to prove it because I want that knucklehead that talks to me about how this game looks just like the last one to look at this. So, right here is a Transformers, and you can see that I have a central shot pretty much right up the middle, accessible to both from both flippers. I have the captive Camaro feature right here, the Decepticon ramp, which has a really cool end that you've never seen in pinball either. The ball goes up, and without any of the obvious walls that are typically used in ramps, it spins around. Right here, you have the Megatron feature, and then you have orbits and a right ramp, right? And I'm not making this up. There's a guy on RGP that said that Lord of the Rings and Transformers were identical. And so, to the right, I have Lord of the Rings. So, I'm not particularly sure. There are 3 and 3 pop bumpers, and there are 2 flippers at the bottom. But I never ceases to amaze me. And then, just to prove the point, here's Batman. So, if those 3 look the same to you, then I believe you need glasses. Okay, so here's my shout out to Dell Precision Professional Workstations and NVIDIA graphics cards, because this machine has now got 3 CAD systems with huge files all open, and look at this fun. Okay, did you ever look at it? So see that? You know what that is? That, my friends, is the AllSpark Cube. It has the power to create worlds. Did you ever wonder what it looks like if you're the ball as you approach the Decepticon ramp? There it is. Laser cut alloy. Gary asked me to change it to laser cut steel, because, you know, alloy is kind of a newfangled word. And so this, ladies and gentlemen, is the modern world. I have, of course, this drawing was exposed to a bunch of, National Security Agency sensors, and they stripped out all of the LE stuff. So, some of the pro stuff is missing too, but, I don't actually model a Bumblebee Camaro in order to do the feature. I just kind of measure them and lay them in there. But so this is how we work in the modern times. This is pretty cool stuff. This is a level of precision and accuracy never, ever, ever available to us. And you can see every nut and bolt. And when something runs into something like that right there, I know it. Right? And so these are George Gomez ramps, never ever before done in a pinball machine other than in Batman Standard. So you will see the power of these ramps is that they are arted. Every surface is arted, and every surface is laser cut. So I get to do all kinds of cool things. But, these crazy shapes, and I'm all about the details, you know. every product in the world, everything from your iPhone to a BMW is only as good as the details. If the details are bad, the product is more than likely bad. So, the famous modernist architect Mies van der Rohe said, "God is in the details," and I absolutely, positively believe that. I am upset when my stuff goes out and something is not detailed to the level that I like. And I say that to you because I don't always have total control of that detailing. Sometimes I have to make decisions in a rush because I made a mistake. Sometimes I have time constraints or cost constraints or something, or there's just too much to do and I have to pick my battles. But if it was up to me, everything that I designed, I purposely, the engineer was telling me, no, just let me do it. And I said, I want to make sure that little housing, that little molded housing for the flash lamp fits around all my plastics. I want to make sure that it, doesn't interfere with anything. I want to make sure that it's all like perfect. So, he just says, okay, less work for me. Go ahead. So this is really cool stuff. This is the most amazing thing about this is of course, you've heard all this conversation about rapid prototyping, and absolutely. My models, drawings today are sort of an afterthought, meaning it's drawings are made for quality control departments. So when the part comes in, they can check it against a drawing. But real parts are typically made by you handing your CAD model to the manufacturer of the part, and then he takes that CAD model and feeds it into his tooling, and the parts are made. And that happens for our laser cut plastics, our formed ramps, our injection molded plastics, whatever it is. That's how it works in the world today. It's incredibly powerful. I love it. I don't know how it is that I did it before. I did do it before. We put men on the moon with guys, sharpening 2H pencils. So it did work. I love the level of control. I love the level of accuracy. I love messing around with all this stuff, the power of it. Oh, look it. Here's one. The NSA sensors missed this. Why is there a motor hanging on the back of that back panel? Oh, my goodness. But there's a ramp there. What could this motor have to do with this ramp? I don't know. Yikes. Wow. Well, you guys saw a good one today. Okay, other than answering your questions as best I can without giving you secrets about the LEs that I'm not ready to give you just yet, let's do Q&A, because that's it. Yes, sir.
I'm just wondering, what was your favorite playfield gizmo that you came up with?
Wow. I'll tell you what. For a long time, it's been the Batman crane. I love the flexibility of the gadget. I love all the different ways that we invent. I know when I've made a good one, because from the time that I invent it to the time that we ship the game, 10 guys have come up with better ways of using it than I originally dreamt up. So, and that's my bar for is it good or is it bad? Because that thing sat in Lyman's office for 3 days once I got it running, and he had more ideas about what to do with it than I had come up. My original idea was, hey, we'll park it in front of shots. Hey, we'll oscillate it and move it, etc. And it was like he was just bubbling over with excitement. And to me, that's the sign of a that the designer has come up with a cool thing that is really gonna. That's the genesis of ideas.
Does that mean we'll see it again?
I'm sorry?
Does that mean we'll see it again?
You know what? If you think hard, you've actually seen it 3 times from me. The very first time I did it was the Defender mech on NBA Fast Break. It was a guy on an arm and with 4 holes around it, and you could pass the ball from hole to hole, and you had to beat him to the hole in order to make your shot on basket. And it was essentially an arm with a guy on it, right? I then a few years later, revived it for Dracula in Monster Bash. Okay? And it was a different, different location, different implementation, but that's what it was. And I brought it back for Batman. And where'd you see it last?
Stones.
My good friend Tom Coppera was the designer of Stones. And so, and Tom and I, if you know anything about my pinball history, Tom was my mechanical engineer for Corvette, Johnny Mnemonic, and NBA Fast Break. And so Tom said to me, he said, do you mind? I said, no, go for it. So, yeah.
A question. Since your design degree and stuff was earlier on before all the CAD tools and stuff, did you self-learn all the new stuff and everything and get in?
Yeah, I was very lucky. I went to Williams just as they were adopting AutoCAD. And so they were sending all of the designers to CAD school. And I, they were sending all of, okay, I'll do it from here. So they were sending all the designers to CAD school, including Steve Kordak. You know who Steve Kordak is? Steve Kordak went to school with Steve Ritchie, Brian Eddy, myself. I'm not kidding. And Steve Kordak sat in those, you know, and learned CAD with the rest of us. Since then I've taught myself almost everything. I taught myself 3D. I taught myself, 3D Studio Max. You have to remember, I came up in some environments. SolidWorks was the toughest to teach myself because I was, at the time when I was learning SolidWorks, I was alone working in my house by myself. And so I literally had no one to ask. But 3D Studio Max, I learned because I worked at a big, huge video game company and I ran a design team and I had like some absolute killer guys at those tools. And so as I was trying to learn them, you know, when I did the Spy Hunter project, that truck, I modeled all of that. When I was doing that stuff, I could run down the hallway and say, hey, you know, I'm stuck, what do I do? And so, yeah.
There was some Batman slides you were showing. I was wondering if you could speak about more.
Yeah.
One that looked like balls were flying out of multi-ball.
Yeah. It's funny, I get asked about that device a lot. And right. So I was gonna have balls nest in a disc on the playfield. I was gonna sense that they were there, and then I was gonna spin the disc, and centrifugal force was gonna throw the balls off the disc. You may still see that from me one day. So there you go. You may still see that from me one day. Remember that. Yes, sir.
Thanks for your games, by the way.
My pleasure.
What was there anything cost cut from Transformers that you really wanted to be in?
Cost cut. I would have liked to do more transformations, but there isn't like one device. It was more like I wanted every single Transformer to transform. And actually, I said that to Gary, and he just kind of like shook his head and walked out of my office. Yes, sir.
What's your take on the lack of like original, non-licensed art in pinball machines? Like, I don't know if we'll ever get another one.
Some licenses are more flexible than others. So, for example, in Batman, the painting of Michael Caine is a painting. It's not from, Kevin O'Connor did it the old-fashioned way, just like you would do any painting. There was no CG asset for that. So I think that if the assets are good, you know, you use them. If the assets are not, then you don't. Not every license has great assets, and not every, you know, I don't think that you're stuck. I don't think it's like we won't ever see it again or anything like that. I just think we happen to be in, you know, we happen to be on some themes right now that are like pretty richly populated with art. So, you know, if you do, you know, you do something like this, and, you know, it would have been foolish for me to ignore. You know, it would have been foolish for me to torture Kevin. Here, I want you to paint every bolt on this guy. You know, right? So as it is, we kind of broke the mold a little bit because I posed some of those robots that he, you know, that we ended up rendering. And so it's a new world. It's a new day. And it's like it would be foolish for me to sort of ignore some of the power that I have now. I love an original, you know, I mean, I love games that are all original art. I mean, when we, we did Monster Bash, we had zero reference material other than the stuff that existed. But it wasn't like, you know, nobody sent me a style guide for the Universal Monsters. You know, it was you know.
So we've spoken about the power of the tools, the CAD CAM or mechanical. Where does the software for these games stand from a tool standpoint? Is that advanced anything near?
Yeah, the software tools, the thing about the software tools is that they're really driven by the system that you operate in. And so think of the system, think of when you open your computer, you work in Windows or you work in the Mac OS, right? So when you program a pinball game, you work in the Stern OS. And so when a programmer sits down to work on a pinball machine, just like a designer, imagine that a designer has a toolbox of mechanisms. These are all the mechanisms that we've ever done, and you can do anything you want with these. Everyone probably wants to redesign a drop target, but the fact is that we have one. So, when a programmer sits down to program a pinball machine, he has an equivalent tool set. And that tool set, some of it is proprietary, stuff that we wrote, drivers that we wrote for our mechanisms, but we have a library of that stuff. As far as the biggest limitations in their world are not related to the tool set. They're related to the horsepower that the end product runs on. So that's why, you know, we have a new electronic system in the works that's going to give them a tremendous amount more power. It's going to bring them into the modern world. It's going to give them abilities that they don't have, and it's going to make their lives easier.
From a licensing perspective, was there anything that you wanted to do with Transformers that you were told you could not do?
Yeah, really minor stuff, though. For example, I wonder if I have it. I did not realize this, but let's see. Okay, close your eyes now, because you know, we're in that section that the NSA sensors locked out. So let's see here. Look at this. The sensors are gonna. They're just gonna. I'm just going to jail for showing you some of this stuff here. Okay, we're going to have to do this by me waving my arms because I'm really afraid I'm going to click on one of these folders and you're going to see something I don't want you to see. So the shields, the Decepticon and Autobot shield, I wanted a version in which they were cut right down the middle and married. And that is a no-no, will not happen, cannot happen in the world of Transformers.
By licensing?
Right. But Hasbro has been actually a tremendous partner. They, in the toy design building at Hasbro in Pawtucket, they have a 25-foot high tall Optimus in the lobby. And they are so excited about this product that they told me that the pinball machine is going next to it. Sorry?
Is that a moral issue that you can't?
No idea. I have no idea. I just know you can't. Yes, sir.
I have a question more on general game design.
Yep.
When you start a game,
yep.
Do you have, just like the Batman, the multi-ball spinner,
uh-huh.
Do you have a bag of tricks that you're looking at thinking, someday I'm going to use that? Or do you just...
No, I don't. I really don't drive to it that way. I actually drive. I mean, every designer's different, but I drive to it from. To me, the best games are, thematically and executionally consistent. You know, in other words, everything makes sense in my world under the glass. I don't want something that has nothing to do with anything. And I have created exceptions to the rule, and I'll tell you what they are. I think that when I sit down, I immerse myself in the mythos of the thing that I'm working on, right? I've been really fortunate because in the best way, I've loved a lot of the things that I've worked on. So there have been exceptions. I mean, you guys will be surprised to know that I was not a huge Lord of the Rings guy. Okay, I had to sort of come up to speed. And I mean, I tell the story all the time. I was working with it's a good thing that Keith Johnson was, because I sure wasn't. And I knew what I wanted to do with the game. And so I walked into Keith's office one day and I said, I'm going to put that big red fire guy in the middle. And he lost his mind. Dude, that's the Balrog. Yeah, you know, the big red fire guy. So, but like, for example, Batman, I was chomping at the bit because I grew up with the fiction. I loved the fiction. I knew everything about it. I could finish the, I flew to the studio with Lyman, and we got walk through, you know, 10 security doors and put in a locked room with a bottle of water and, you know, and a guy outside standing there, you know, with a thing in his ear. And they handed us two scripts, you know, and they said, okay, you know, these scripts are different, so we will know if one of you leaks something in these scripts. And, you know, I mean, I got out, I'm talking to the director, and I could finish his sentences. I knew what Batman would or wouldn't do. I just knew. So I drive to it from, I immerse myself in the mythos, I try to understand everything about it, and then I sit down and I say, okay, so, you know, what am I going to transform? How am I going to do it? And there are times I may have something in my back pocket, you know. I had the Batman crane is something that's not in any film, you know. It's not in anything. I just, like, I want to do a crane. So, yes, sir.
The promo video or trailer or whatever you want to call it,
yep.
Transformers,
yep.
Is a lot more slickly produced and very expensive looking compared to other. Was there some involvement from Hasbro?
Absolutely not. Actually, I'm really glad you asked that question. It was produced internally. You're going to see a lot of that stuff from us. I want to do things the way that I know how to do them, and that's how I know how to do them. So you're going to see a lot of that stuff from us. That video had nothing to do with Hasbro. Nothing to do with Hasbro.
Is that go same for the Tron one?
I don't know the Tron one, but it didn't come from them, right?
Same guys did it.
Same guys did it. Yeah.
Our guys, because they look, they do.
Yeah, same guys did it. I don't. Yeah. The Tron one was before my time. So, yes, sir.
Yeah, I was the Transformers pinball machine. Will it like have two different high scores things for Decepticons and Autobots? Or
now you're delving into my secrets. You know, I'll tell you what I would do if I were you. Here. I would get familiar with the Decepticon alphabet and the Autobot alphabet, if I were you.
In the promo video that you mentioned, you're showing playing with a Transformer that's articulating. Can you talk about how that's incorporated in the game? What we're seeing there?
You're gonna see the evolution of that in the LE Megatron. So, we live in real times, meaning that I wish that I could take Megatron and turn him from his truck into his robot form, from his alternate, you know, from the tank form into the robot form. And I guarantee you that I could do that. I know precisely how to do it. I could do it. But it would be at the expense of so many other things in your game that I'm not real sure that once you saw the trick once. And so I have to make intelligent decisions about how to entertain you over the long haul. And so you will see that, by the way. But I had much more evolved transformations originally. That's one that you will see.
You have worked on how many pinball machines?
Let's see. Corvette, Johnny Mnemonic, NBA Fast Break, Monster Bash, Revenge from Mars. I did the Castle on Medieval Madness. I've worked on. I did Playboy for Stern. I did Lord of the Rings. I did Batman. I did Batman Standard. Did Transformers. I know I'm forgetting something.
Sopranos.
Thank you. and I have probably done a couple that you've never seen.
So if you look back on those, what in your mind, not necessarily tied to commercial success, has best withstood the test of time? What sort of comes back to you from when you look back and you say, that's really cool, I did a good job here?
Monster Bash is timeless.
But you just mentioned that there are some games we've never seen. Could you talk a little bit about some of those? I'm interested in hearing about Armed and Dangerous.
Oh, well, okay, yeah. Armed and Dangerous was an attempt to do a three-dimensional version of hyperball, meaning the ball's shot through the air as opposed to flat to the playfield. The cool thing about Armed and Dangerous was that I created these fictional characters. It was during one of the comic book renaissances, one of the numerous comic book renaissances. You remember the one where every comic book you opened had this hot babe in spandex wearing lots of guns, right? So Lieutenant Armed and Sergeant Dangerous. Lieutenant Armed was the hot babe, and Sergeant Dangerous was this giant guy, like kingpin size, you know, with huge muscles. The cool thing about Armed and Dangerous was that you could link two of them together. The linking technology for Armed and Dangerous is the linking technology that went into NBA Fast Break, because I actually built Armed and Dangerous, and we were working away on it, and the idea being that your targets belong to me and my targets belong to you. So we're playing side by side. I'm taking out your tanks on my playfield and you're taking out my tanks on your playfield, right? And it worked such that the tank would flash, I'm going to fire, and then a string of lights would come towards you, bam, 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 video game style on the playfield, a bunch of giant red arrow inserts, you know, the giant insert we use. And if you took the hit, it ate at your life. When your life was gone, your life was gone. So it didn't, and I tried a flipper version. The very first one that came up had flippers. And you remember the ball lock in Lord of the Rings with the balls on the sword? Okay, imagine one of those with 20 balls stacked behind it, okay? And so it was like rapid fire. They were on either side of the pinballs, and it would drop the pinballs into the shooter group, you know, into the in lanes, and bam, 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 you know. And it was a flurry of activity. We never got to finish the game. And at the time, Williams had just done its first layoff, and Neil Nicastro came to my office, and he goes, you know what? Here's the problem. I don't know how many of these things I can sell. I don't even know how to begin to talk to someone about them. But he said, if I go to the market and I say, I've got the next George Gomez pinball machine, I am guaranteed someone's going to buy this many of them. So he said, you're going to put this on the shelf. And I put it on the shelf. We saved the linking technology.
No one's pushed pinball farther, Mark. I appreciate you very much.
Oh.
Over the years, you know, I thought about, you know, when you talked about Pin2K, you know, a few years ago or whatever, the one in Chicago. Is there a possibility that the new operating system that Stern is working on could support, you know, multiple small LCD, you know, devices and have some video power that I'm not saying Pin2K, but, you know, incorporate those kinds of things into the next decade? Because obviously whatever's locked into that board set.
Yeah, you know, you've been talking to the NSA sensors, I see.
I spent too much time thinking about your game.
We'll have to wait and see.
I know you want to keep secrets about the LE, but are we going to get to see anything, pictures or anything before they ship?
Yeah, you will. You will. We absolutely intend on, putting stuff out as it comes up or as we feel it's appropriate. It's actually a lot about getting you and keeping you excited about what we're doing. So
you already have my money. Right.
You're gonna like it. Which way'd you go?
I went with the combo.
You're gonna love it. It's got a paint job that is just gonna blow your eyes out. The handguard, the handguard is literally the hand. What do you guys call them? Oh yeah, Gary and I, we come from two different worlds. In the stern world, or what?
Front moldings.
I have to learn front molding. I'm a Willy guy from back then, and it was a hand protector back then. So I have a hard time getting that out of my. I've learned flat rail. Flat rails used to be ball guides in my old world, and pop bumpers used to be jet bumpers. So I've assimilated pretty well, but for some reason that one sticks. That one hangs me up, but. It's split down the middle with the two colors, and the two colors are their custom car cool. I mean, I cannot begin to tell you. Autobot Crimson is got this incredible depth. It's a metallic red with what appears to be layers of luster, and Decepticon Violet is a metallic violet with layers of luster. TF logo in the center, separating the split. You're gonna love it. You're gonna love it.
How many signatures did you come up with before you decided on the final, legendary signature that you have now?
I didn't realize it was legendary. when I was that signature is not new. I have to tell you that. When I was a young designer, at the University of Illinois, trying to figure out how to be a designer, we were all about, everyone wants to be an individual. Everyone wants to have, I want you to recognize my designs for being mine as opposed to, Steve's or somebody else's. And so, part of the package of creating your individuality starts way back then, and so we used to do critiques where you'd have the entire class in a room and see, the thing about design school is that it's really brutal. You can't hide because you essentially put your work up. And your work is visible to everyone. So the work really speaks for itself. I tell people, I say, if you hire a mechanical engineer, you don't know if he's any good until after he's worked for you for 6 months. Because no one, when he walks in the door, he says, here's my degree, here's where I come from, here's what I do. No one gives him a test, right? When you hire a designer, in the old days, you brought a portfolio. And you put it on the table and you paged through it. And right away you're looking, and it's the stuff's either good or it's not. So it's that, by the way, is the reason there are so many unemployed designers, because there's a lot of mediocre designers, because it's a tough bar. It's a really tough bar, because here it is. So we would sit in these critiques with all the drawings on the wall, and everybody had to, I had to be better than all the other guys, and they had to be better than me. And so everybody, every iota of individualism, it got so obnoxious that I had one teacher that said, you will all work in the same color paper, you will all use the same color markers, and that will be 3 markers, not 10, and I will tell you what the colors are, so that he could look past the nonsense of our individualism to the quality of the product itself.
Besides being the designer of Transformers, we know hired on for your position. Can you say a little bit more about that? More pertaining to, we've recently seen pictures of you and Borg talking about stuff.
Vice President of Game Development is a really cool job, because I will design from time to time. You are going to see my games in the queue, but the reality is that my job is vision, right? My job is to bring vision to the product, to the company, to the direction. And so I'm not going to hold Borg's hand. He's a big boy, and he knows exactly what he's doing. I'm not going to hold Steve's hand. He's one of my mentors, right? I broke in under him. The reason my play fields feel the way they do, similarly to his, is because I learned from him. So, I have a thing or two to say about, you know, how to make the product cooler. And so I told those guys, I said, you know, I'm gonna try to be the, you know, I'm gonna try to protect you, keep the wolves at bay, let you do what you do, and help you do what you do. And that's really my job. It's try to create, you know, a direction for the product development in our company that I'm proud of, you know.
With the Pro version and the LE version, do you start with the Pro, then go with the LE, or do you start with the LE and
Right. It's a subject of great debate at this point, because we haven't done enough of them. I do know that LEs are going to be full featured games, and there are some mechanics relative to the, you know, how you do things that are in conflict with the order. You know, in other words, there are pros and cons to both approaches. If you do an LE first, you remove things. If you do a pro first, you add things. Adding and removing is not as simple as you would imagine, even in the world of CAD. It's not adding it to the CAD that's the problem. It's not any of that. Some of it is material control. Some of it is the fact that we're essentially saying, hey, our deepest game has to come out first. So we're trying to get better at it. There are also some sales and marketing concerns, right? The customers that we feed first are customers in Europe, and yet they don't consume LEs; they consume pros. And so there are, you know, there's some debate. Some debate internally.
How did you approach Transformers in that respect?
I approached it, functionally from sort of. I actually did it backwards in a sense. I did the Pro first, and I had in the back of my mind I had the elements of the LE, but they were strictly, you know, they were sketched in, if you will. They weren't completely locked down designs at the point where, when I started. In other words, when I started, I didn't have a fully fleshed out, totally, this is entirely every LE device. I knew there was going to be you saw me playing with the Megatron thing, so that was pretty early on. So I knew that was going in there. But you also saw him wearing an Optimus head, right? So... And way in the back.
Yeah, what if someone buys a Pro and they like the game? Is there ever going to be like a upgrade conversion kit to give similar features?
Nope. It sort of it defeats the purpose of the LE in some ways.
It sounds like you got a little bit into the programming behind the machine also, and I've noticed over the years. I know somebody said video modes earlier, but one of the things I see missing a lot, and I'm not sure if it's a restriction on the hardware or what, but like instant info really doesn't tell you anything.
Right.
Like on the Tron, there's so many shots to hit, and so many, hit it five times.
Yeah, that's right. What's funny about that is that you would think that would be a help to a novice, and it's actually a point of confusion. And so so we've debated a lot about, how to handle that. And it's just a matter of we don't have a great philosophical solution, design solution to the problem. But we've had this discussion. We've had this discussion a lot. You know, should that be in? You know, what should we do with it? You know, and so we're, one of the things we're trying to do is not only you know, keep you guys happy, but we need the next generation of you guys. And so we need to teach people how to play. And we need to expose them to the product in such a way that, you know, they can learn. And it's in, you know, it doesn't make sense to me, but that's one of the things that was called out as a point of confusion to a novice. Right? You'd think, well, that doesn't make any sense. You're giving me information.
I don't see a novice if they're holding the flipper for 3 seconds for this.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you have a shaker motor in the transformer?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Pro, premium, and pro LEs.
Oh, yeah, not in the pros. In the all of the LEs. Both versions, I'm thinking Autobot, Decepticon. Yes, sir.
Oh, I just back to designing and using CAD. I'm curious about the physics and the math behind it. How much of that is done or integrated into CAD? Is that all done on the whiteboard?
The physics, okay, so the CAD tools have incredible power, including simulation, which is what you're referring to. So we limit simulation to the things that we really need to simulate. So, for example, there were a lot of concerns about the strength of the Batman crane, and we ran it through finite element analysis in order to verify that it was going to be strong enough. And it is one of the most reliable devices we've ever made. And it is because of stuff like that. So I think it's going to become more prevalent. I think that a designer still uses his gut when he starts. And, you know, pinball design in some ways is a black art, right? It's like if you don't hang around with other pinball designers, you don't learn how to design pinball machines. It's very hard. I was very fortunate, very, very fortunate that my body of work got me in the door, and then I was surrounded by, and I had all the arrogance to imagine that I could do it, really. I just like, I don't know how I did, but I did. And my office was across the hall from Steve Ritchie's. Literally across the hall. And at 3 o'clock, he would close the door, and I would hear like Jimi Hendrix riffs, you know, coming out the door because he kept a guitar and an amp in his office. And he would, it's the stories are endless. Yes, sir.
Sound design.
Yep.
How much control do you usually have, whether especially like quotes, things like that, like Drac doing James Brown references and Monster Bash?
Yeah.
You're saying you weren't that familiar with Lord of the Rings, like who would choose all the quotes from like a Lord of the Rings game?
Right. So in something like in Lord, it was actually pretty easy because we had with films, we get a bunch of stuff. We listen to the soundtracks, and we go, oh, you know, that would fit here, right? And so we start out with that, and then we sit down and we write stuff. I actually like to write stuff for audio, so there's a bunch of audio that, you know, that I've written for all my games. You know, I will mesmerize you with my semicircular motion. You can blame me for that. So... I have a lot of control, you know. I mean, the audio guy is—he's the master of his domain. But you know, I get to play film director, and I get to say, you know, hey, I want this or I like that, and they usually accommodate me. It's, you know, I invented Lyman's Lament. I said, Lyman, if you don't stop bitching, I'm going to make a thing called Lyman's Lament, and I did.
Is there an underlying competition between you designers, and what do you know of
You know, at Willy, that was the tradition. Yeah. At Willy, there were, you know, you've heard me say this before. I think some of you have. It was like when I walked in the door at Willy, there were 7 street gangs. And there were 2 gang lords that the street gangs had affiliations to. You know, there was the Lawler, you know, faction, you know, the Blues, and there was the Steve faction, the Reds. And so, and that's an exaggeration because, you know, we all got along and survived and learned from each other. But there was a lot of competition, and at Stern, it's a very different animal. We're not that way. And plus, we're more mature than we were back then. We were younger, and we are too small to... to play games of that sort. We really just, I want, you know, I'm ecstatic if Borg's game runs, and if it runs longer than mine, who cares? You know, I mean, it's, and the same thing with Steve, you know, I mean, it's like, we are designers and we're individuals and we have philosophical differences. And, you know, I have philosophical differences with Gary. We fight all the time. We also agree all the time. But it's part of the, it's the chemistry, you know, it's the chemistry, right? You don't want yes men around you, you know, and we, right now, if I hadn't had John Borg helping me get my game down the line, he's taken time from his game to, you know, be out there with me chasing ball traps. And sometimes I'm like, John, I got to release these drawings. Can you work with the line on this particular problem? And, you know, he's out there hammering it away. So, the thing that just went up online was so funny, you know. Borg and I were just getting a great kick out of the fact that somebody took like this little corner of the playfield and enlarged it up. But John and I were going, "Wow, look at that! They can see a GI." Yes, sir.
Last question, please.
Dream theme for you. What's the thing you wish you could do?
The dream team for me is you got two like major league hitters coming up right behind me. Dream theme. Wow, that's a tough one. You know, it's like I'm like you know, Gary says his favorite game is the one he's selling, and and you know, my favorite game is the one I'm designing. Okay, one more. Yes, sir.
Do you receive like a checklist from the franchise holder, the people who own the film, for instance, of things you have to put in?
No, not at all. Never, ever. We get a style guide, which basically helps us. It's sort of to help us, like, you know, this is the way something would look, or this is, you know, this is like, they're very picky about things like, you know, PMS color number, you know, 192 for this particular character or something. You know, they're very picky about stuff like that, but never, ever. They understand they don't know our business, and they don't want to intrude on our business. We educate them. We have a little process that we go through in the beginning when we start working with people that we haven't worked with before. We take them through the process. You know, we say, okay, you know, this is what a pinball machine's all about, and this is how it works, and this is what we do, and these are the things that we're going to need your, you know, your approvals on and stuff like that. So, but I can't think of a single time and all the licenses I've worked on where they told us what to do.
I've wondered about that for 30 years. Thanks.
Never once. That's it.